This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Paris, and in particular, the Prince de Gaulle Hotel right here. And I first came to Paris when I was 12 years old. I flew Pan Am to Orly. The plane, there was an emergency on the ground. We had to circle in the air. I threw up. That was my very first jet experience. And then I had the best time ever. I still have the ugliest little metal Eiffel Tower souvenir I got when I was 12 years old. I still have it today. And I remember my mother had booked the trip through a travel agent, and our itinerary was typewritten on onion skin paper. And we followed it to the max, and we had such a great time. And later this year, I think I have that itinerary. I'm going to repeat it. I'm going to repeat it many, many years later. My next guest, contributor to NPR, The New York Times, Jake Cigarano. Did I get it right? I did.
Cigarano.
Yes. You know what? I tried. I really tried, Jake. This much we know. He's from Texas.
That's right.
And an expat. How long have you lived here?
I've lived here for 5 years now, Peter.
And reporting for all these different organizations.
Yes.
What about it brought you to Paris? What about the city?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've found that Americans fetishize Paris. Everyone has this dream of coming to Paris. And I never had that dream. So the first time I came was in 2010.
You were forced to come?
I was forced to come. No, I came of my own volition. But I came in 2010 to visit a friend who was living here at the time. And a week visit turned into several months.
Well, what was the turning point for you?
Well, I think once I arrived and started meeting people and seeing what the city was all about is what made me so passionate about the city and really fall in love with it. And I suddenly got it. And then I started reading the literature, of course, the greats, Fitzgerald and Hemingway and their experiences. And then I understood what this American ideal of Paris was and why people were so attracted to the city.
Now, of course, you've seen the movie Midnight in Paris how many times?
Just once.
Okay. But what was interesting about that movie was when they were talking about the good old days, and you went and found out that they weren't so good when they were old. Everybody has that sort of a sentimental recollection or perception of the past.
Right, the nostalgia of it. That's right. I mean, I think there's a lot of nostalgia involved in Paris. People come here looking for that. But what's great is that they come and they can find that, but then they create these new experiences that give them even more love for Paris beyond that nostalgia.
Now, the very first time you came, you went to the Louvre, didn't you?
No, can you believe I didn't even go to the Louvre until I actually moved here in 2012. So I had never been to the Louvre until I actually was living here.
And did you take a selfie view in front of the Iampe statue?
I did not. Selfies weren't such a thing 5 years ago. Thank God.
Exactly. For me, I mean, I love Musée d'Orsay. I like it better than the Louvre, just because of the light.
Well, you know what I like better than the Musée d'Orsay?
Oh, come on, one up me now. Come on.
Is the Lingerie, which is the little sister museum of the Musée d'Orsay. I like to think of it as where all of the paintings that the Musée d'Orsay thinks aren't good enough to go into the main museum get to hang out. And so you also have these fabulous paintings, murals of Monet, his water lily cycle. So you have these two oval rooms that are just magnificent and breathtaking.
All right, so now that you've opened that door, give me a museum that's neither of those. That's your little secret museum.
My little secret museum. It's not so much of a secret, but I will tell you that the Rodin Museum is absolutely fabulous. It was just renovated last year, and it is one of the most beautiful museums and beautiful spaces here in Paris. And how can you resist a place where the artist actually lived and worked and now serves as the church of his work?
I mean, there's a lot of history there.
Absolutely. And also, just a couple of weeks ago, a new museum opened in honor of Camille Claudel, who was Rodin's lover. And so you have that.
All right, now we're talking.
Okay. Yes, it gets very scandalous. So Camille Claudel was Rodin's lover, and she lived in his shadow for a very long time, but she was never really recognized in her own time as an artist of brilliance that she was. But now the French state is actually giving her national recognition as an important state treasure.
When you got here for the first time and then you had that experience, was it the food? Was it the art? Was it the music? Was it the history?
It's a combination of all of those things. But what stood out to me the most were the people that I were meeting, that I was meeting, just the hospitality and, you know,
this which is very... went against the stereotype.
Absolutely. I love when people come to Paris and say, oh, the French were so much nicer than I expected. Well, yes, you know, you have this false idea in your head about the French, but it's very cliche to say, but the French do have a joie de vivre that is just undeniable.
I will say you this, and I totally agree with you. I mean, I've been coming since I'm 12. I've never had a bad experience. But I've seen other people have bad experiences, and that's because of their attitude, not the French.
That's right. And I think people come here with a lot of expectations that automatically color what their experience is going to be. And what I suggest is for people to come with an open mind, an open heart, and, of course, a few words of French to butter up our French comrades.
Like, où est le bain?
Où est le toilette?
Yeah.
Yes, where are the toilets? That's very important.
Not necessarily the public toilets.
Correct, no.
You don't want
we
to do that.
Stay away from those.
No.
No.
We're talking with Jake Siganero.
Siganero.
I'm going to get
all
this right on the third time.
Third time's a charm.
Okay.
Yep.
Siganero.
Perfect.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Regular contributor to NPR and the New York Times, and now an expat living here in Paris for the last, 5 years?
5 years.
Yeah. Now that you're here, I'm going to take a wild guess. All your friends are visiting you. They're all showing up.
No, you know, that's what's interesting.
They don't show up.
People do show up, but as you were just discussing earlier, people are reluctant to go to places after terror attacks. And so my closest friend from high school actually didn't come visit until just a month ago because he and his wife were a little bit leery of danger.
And did he survive?
He survived, and I almost had to throw him into the Seine River because we were walking along and they had just seen Notre Dame, and he said, wow, if I had known Paris was this beautiful, we would have been here a lot sooner, and I could have hit him right there.
You should have hit him right there.
I should have, but I'm nicer than that.
But I'll go one step further because, you know, the worst four-letter word that starts with F when it comes to travel is fear.
Yes.
And every time I've come to Paris in the last 3 years, I get emails from all my friends saying, be safe. Have they been on the San Diego freeway? I mean, I'm not worried about being in Paris, unless if I'm not looking when I'm crossing the street, you know, because we understand that everybody in Paris drives like the gumball rally. But forgetting that, do you feel unsafe here?
I don't feel unsafe. Sadly, terrorism has become more of a habit here, or we become more habituated to it. But we can't be afraid. Otherwise, the terrorists win. So we have to keep living our lives. If we didn't go anywhere where there was an attack or danger, we wouldn't travel at all.
And you do travel. The French travel.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They travel around France. They go to Europe. It's absolutely, you have to keep moving.
I mean, when you had the shooting in April where the policeman was killed and two others were wounded, and they closed the Champs-Élysées for one night on a Thursday night, by Friday, I mean, I'm not trying to be insensitive. Obviously, it was a tragedy, and people lost their, at least one person lost their life, actually two if you include the terrorists. It was back to business as usual.
Right. I was walking there just that weekend, and it was packed with people. There were people out. They were playing music. They were shopping. It was life returning to normal.
Or is the terrorism normal?
I don't want to say that it's normal because it's not normal. Of course, we don't want this at all, but
right.
It's something, it's the reality that we live in and that you have to deal with.
Well, the other reality that you deal with are some of the more interesting characters here living in Paris who don't show up in the guidebooks or the brochures. Tell me about the Rembrandt guy.
So yes, Mr. Tom Kaplan, he's been an anonymous Rembrandt collector since 2002. In fact, he has the largest private collection of Rembrandts in the world. And no one knew that he had this collection until recently, because he went public with that, putting on display some of those works at the Louvre Museum.
I mean, they're exhibiting his collection. He loaned it.
Yes, he loaned these works. In fact, he also donated one of the paintings, not a Rembrandt, but a bowl, to the Louvre Museum.
Okay, stupid question. When you say you've got the largest private collection of Rembrandts in the world, how many paintings are we talking about?
More than 200, but not all of those are Rembrandts.
One of them is a Murray Rembrandt, one's a Helen Rembrandt.
No, not exactly. Well, but the other thing is that he has never lived with any of these works either. I mean, there is also the issue of where do you hang a Rembrandt in your house? It's a little bit tacky, in my opinion. But he's been loaning these paintings to institutions.
Okay, let's go back to
all over.
Where, yes. Is this the first time he's ever exhibited them?
No, he's been loaning these paintings all over the world to all of these institutions.
So he keeps them in a warehouse and then loans them out?
Actually, he says that there is never a painting that's not in an institution at any given moment, because they are so in demand. In fact, when he first started collecting Rembrandts, which has been a childhood passion since he was 6 years old, he said that his goal was to take these paintings out of private hands where people weren't seeing them and put them into the public so that people could enjoy them.
Wild. And so how did you find him?
So I found him because I saw that this show was coming up at the Louvre about the Dutch masters. And so I started inquiring about where the paintings were coming from. And the press representatives started talking to me about Mr. Kaplan's story and said that he was ready to go public.
And there you go.
There you go.
Has he changed since your story ran about this guy?
In what way?
Is he gone more public?
Absolutely. He's going all out. He is putting his name out there. He wants to make sure that as many people as possible see these paintings. And in fact, this show is going to travel around the world, to China, to the Middle East, I believe in the Gulf, and then eventually to the U.S.
Wow. So when your friends finally showed up after all those years, where did you take them?
Well, I only had about 36 hours to show them the best time in Paris. So I took them to Montmartre, of course, it wasn't a French meal, but we had Italian. And then we walked up to, yes.
Really?
Well, you can only have, I had to maximize their European experience while they were here. So
because this was it.
Yes, exactly, for them. So we did have French food. I took them to a wine bar. I took them to Montmartre. We walked around the Marais. We walked along the Seine.
Notre Dame,
as I mentioned earlier. Yes, absolutely.
Catacombs?
No catacombs. No time for the catacombs.
Too bad.
We fit in quite a bit for 36 hours.
Hey, by the way, have they finally taken all the locks off the bridges?
They did, and they started replacing them. There are some bridges that still have the locks, but they've
put up glass panels. Let me explain. I love the idea that you came to Paris with your significant other. You either bought the lock and a key at a hardware store in the United States or anywhere else in Paris. And then hopefully with indelible magic marker, you would write your initials or a message about your love for each other and lock it on the fence on the bridge and throw the key in the river.
I hate the idea.
Well, okay.
I think it's cheesy.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Whatever happened to all those locks?
Part of the bridge actually fell into the Seine, the railing.
Because of the weight of all the locks.
Yeah, the weight of all the locks. So number one, it's a danger is one reason why I'm against this. But the other reason is I think it's an eyesore. The idea is nice, but the actual physical appearance of it is not great.
All right, so maybe they should just do a wall, a special commemorative wall.
I think that'd work.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, good. So they got rid of the locks.
They got rid of the locks.
Now how do you get rid of the locks? Did you erect a railing on the bridge that can't be fastened with anything?
Yes, so they shut down the bridge, they took out all of the wiring that had the locks on it, and then they actually put up plexiglass panels. I believe it's plexiglass, but it's clear panels that you can't put anything on. Of course,
they'll tag it,
they'll scratch it up, but they try to keep that pretty clean as well now.
Where do you go to hang out for either breakfast, lunch, or dinner? That's not in the guidebook, that's not in the brochures.
My own neighborhood, where else?
Tell me.
So, all right, I live in the 19th, which is in the northeast of Paris, and it's on a part of the canal that is not so popular with tourists. It's not the Canal Saint-Martin, but it's the Canal Ourcq. And so there are a lot of shops, a lot of restaurants that are opening up there.
Okay, it's, breakfast? Yes. Where do you go for breakfast?
Breakfast. There's this great place called Café 19, and it's Café 19. And it's actually a German coffee house run by a Canadian.
Of course.
Yes, but they have delicious coffee. Me, I love coffee, but I'm not a fan of the typical French coffee. I prefer Italian-style coffee. And these guys do Italian-style espresso. And they have the most wonderful baked goods. It always smells so good in there because they're always cooking something in the oven.
Okay, so we've taken care of breakfast. Yes. Lunch?
Lunch. I love this restaurant called Mademoiselle in the Marais. And they do French food, but with a little bit of a contemporary twist. So you'll get some burrata in there, or you'll get French-style egg rolls. It's delicious, and the staff there is very nice.
And last but not least, of course, dinner.
Oh, dinner. This is a hard one. I would have to say, oh my God, where do I go for dinner? There's a great place in the 18th called Au Bon Coin, and it is packed with locals, and it's maybe the best duck I've ever had in Paris.
Okay, we've done it.
All right.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I am a passenger.
So many folks in America, France is their number one destination they want to go to. And I always argue the reason for that is that they're all failed art history majors. They study the painting in school. They feel they better go over and see it once, and they stand in line for 11 hours at the Louvre and come out and go, it's so small. Well, they do that. I can't believe how many people do that. They still do it. But if you're an evolved traveler and you still want to go to France, my next guest might be able to help you in a much more genuine and authentic way. Her name is Emily Thibault. She has written an amazing book called The France Just for You. Because it's a great tour guide, but it's a different way to see France. And I think it's really up close and personal because you're outside of Paris. Yes, you may land in Paris, but then you're going to go out. And Emily, where are you going out?
I go out to Normandy, to the Loire Valley, the Castles country. I go out to Provence, to the Riviera, Dordogne, Bordeaux region, many regions like.
But you're doing it in a very small way, in terms of a more intimate way.
Yes, I try to have my travelers see France through my eyes. So my husband and I have traveled a lot, and we figured out that sometimes you kind of miss a country when, you know, you don't get to interact with locals. So
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So what we do is have our travelers stay at premium bed and breakfast, so they get to meet with French people and interact with them. Moreover, our host can speak some English, so they don't have the language barrier and can really get to understand and feel the French culture.
Plus, they're right there in the middle of the community.
Yes, definitely.
So it's one thing to say you're staying at a French B&B, but then what you do is much more than that.
Yeah, because we craft their daily suggested itineraries for each couple traveling with us. They tell us what they like and what they dislike. And based on that, we plan every day of their trip. They have no commitments, much one or two during the week, but the rest of the time they are free, but they know where to go, what to do, where to have lunch or dinner. They have many suggestions, and this we really craft based on our travelers' wishes and expectations.
I would think that, you know, if I were going to be coming to you, I would tell you, I just don't want to visit a winery. I'd like to help pick the grapes. Or I don't want to just be in the kitchen. I want to make the crepes.
Yeah.
Can I do that?
Yeah, definitely. I explore France all the time and find new people to meet and new activities for my travelers. So definitely, for instance, like cooking class. You took this example. I don't like my travelers to be at a cooking class, which is 12 students and one chef that nobody wants to address to. I take my travelers to a chef who is at home and have them welcome them in his own home.
So
have
it's really
them cook
one
in the
on
afternoon.
It's one-on-one.
Yeah, and enjoy dinner all together at night. So it's the type of experience I'm looking for. It's difficult to find in Paris. And as you said, in Provence or in Normandy, I can definitely do that.
I can't think of something... I can think of something less desirable when you think about it than being stuck on a bus, right? So really, it's one-on-one, it's hands-on, you're immersing yourself.
Yeah, and the thing is, as my travelers are driving the car, automatic car, because I know that it's complicated to stick shift to Americans, so they have automatic cars, they have all GPS coordinates, even for the parking lots, so they know in every town they will arrive, they know where to park.
And so you understand the geographic ignorance of Americans, don't you?
Yeah, I've lived in the U.S.
Oh, okay, fine, just double-checking. Okay, but that's helpful.
Yes. I try, you know, to put myself in my traveler's shoes and make their life more comfortable.
So when they tell you what they want or what they're interested in, how creative can you get? I mean, what would you say is a wild example of what you personally crafted for one group?
For one couple?
Yeah.
For instance, I had a couple, their last name was the name of a valet in the Pyrenees. And they wanted to go back to their ancestors. So I, you know, organized their whole journey so they could go back to this special valley, take a private guided tour, and we could find, you know, graveyards and any information, you know, for them to make their trip very, very special. So this is something we often do because many Americans come from the old Europe. And those who have information about their ancestors are happy to go back to a little town, which is not a touristy place. But, you know, if we can put it in the middle of their trip, they can enjoy, you know, well-famous places, but also get to see where their ancestors came from.
Is it just couples or could it be families?
Yeah, we have some families with mostly couples, very often two couples traveling together. And
they still talk to each other at the end of the trip?
Yeah. I found that American people like to travel to couples together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, please tell me, nobody's asking you to go to McDonald's.
No, and I never recommend it.
Nobody ever asked?
No. Some of my travelers, I have to admit, in Dordogne, you know, where we eat a lot of foie gras and duck confit and stuff like that. At the end of the week, sometimes my travelers tell me that it's hard for them to digest out of point because it's so different from
enough
what you
foie gras.
Eat in the U.S. It's enough foie gras.
I understand. What would be the best culinary experience you put together for them?
Culinary, to me, it's really getting to a local person at his or her house and cook with him or her, you know, all afternoon long. I can craft any type of dish this person wants to make or any allergy they have. We work around that and, you know, get to see how French people cook, because I know for American people, it's important. Gastronomy is important and they want to discover it while in France. So
the most important thing is that the book that you do,
yeah,
it's a real book just for one couple.
Yes, definitely.
And it's a couple of hundred pages.
Yeah, it's between 300 and 400 pages, yes.
Just for one couple?
Yes.
Wow.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. One of my questions, of course, every time I go to a hotel, especially in Paris, is the history of that hotel. And this hotel certainly has a history. And joining me now, the man who knows more about it than anybody because he's doing the book on it, Andreas Augustin, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Peter.
So, there's a lot of new hotels opening in Paris, some new builds as well. But this hotel goes back how many years?
It's going to be 90 years next year.
So there's a lot of history.
Yep, absolutely.
What screams out to you that most guests who would stay here don't know about the hotel, about the history? Because, you know, people check in, they know the brand, they know they're going to get a great room, but they don't really have a sense
of the meaning of the name.
Yeah, which is?
Prince de Galles, and that means Prince of Wales. And that hints.
Nobody knows that.
Nobody knows that, yes. So I think that's probably.
I mean, I could tell you something that would be embarrassing for me as an American. A lot of my friends thinking I'm staying at the Charles de Gaulle.
Yes.
I mean, right? Am I right?
Yeah. So, Charles de Gaulle, Prince de Galles.
Prince of Wales.
Gaul and Gaul.
And why was it named that?
Well, it was named because the person who built it was naming it after the Prince of Wales in respect for the British crown and in hope that the Prince of Wales, Edward, would stay here.
And did he?
Well, I'm not sure if I can release this already. I can only tell you that Churchill stayed here, Chamberlain stayed here. No, he did never stay here. Funny enough, yeah.
Wow. But the name stayed here.
The name stayed. Yes. It is the Georges V, the street of the English kings. And that's the Avenue Georges V. And that's where we are, right, in the middle of it.
Exactly. So other than Churchill and Chamberlain, who else has stayed here?
I don't want you to wait for my book, but in a way, yes, I do. But I can give you a few stories.
Okay.
What I like to tell is the story about Marlene Dietrich. I guess everybody is familiar with her.
Oh, yeah.
So she stayed here before the war, before the Second World War. And in 1939, she more or less escaped Germany and decided to move to America. She became American, as you probably know. And she left the Prince de Galles in a hurry. And she came back in an American uniform 5 years later, in 1944, in search for 7 suitcases, which she had left in 1939.
Please tell me they were here.
Well, unfortunately not, because they had been moved to Germany and the content had been sold or given to poor people.
Wow.
The German army had taken place here. They had their commander here in this hotel.
Although when you think about it, I mean, what possessed her to think that leaving 7 suitcases before World War II would be taken wonderful care of and they'd be waiting for her?
Well, I can tell you why, because usually that's a standard in a super class hotel like this.
Unless war breaks out.
Well, unless war breaks out and the wrong people move in.
Yeah. The design of the hotel, the architecture of the hotel, the facade of the hotel, when it was closed in 2011, they had to make sure that when they reopened it 2 years later, that they didn't lose the essence of the hotel.
You cannot lose the essence of the facade, but the content is, of course, important. Not to mention that the people who run it are actually the most important content of every hotel in the world. But the architect who actually built it was a not very well-known person called André-Louis Arfidsson. And Mr. Arfidsson didn't really make a big name for himself, but in one respect he did, because he built the first real Art Deco facade here in Paris. The interesting thing to note is that he garnished the hotel with a lot of elements which you find in Art Deco. And interesting enough, next door, another hotel had been built exactly at the same time, and they didn't use any of these elements. So when you go into the courtyard of the Prince de Galles, you see a lot of Art Deco elements gracing the facade and the interior courtyard. And nothing like that is in the surrounding, in the architecture to be found.
There you go. Keep that going. This is Flight 372 on SWA. The flight attendants on board serving you today. Teresa in the middle, David in the back. My name is David, and I'm here to tell you that shortly after takeoff, first things first, there's soft drinks and coffee to quench your thirst. But if you want another kind of drink, then just holler. Alcoholic beverages will be $4. If a Monster energy drink is your plan, that'll be $3, and you get the whole can. We won't take your cash. You gotta
pay. I try to do this every time we do a show from a hotel, because most Americans are intimidated by my next guest. Not her particularly, but by the title. I remember when I first came to Paris, I was 12 years old, and my mother walked into the hotel with me, and she took me by the hand and pointed to the concierge desk and said, "Don't ask them anything." Because in those days, the concierge was a separate entity. It was like a separate fiefdom of the hotel. And at the end of your stay, you got a separate bill from the concierge in addition to the bill from the hotel. And my mother was terrified that if I just asked what time it was, there'd be a bill. Then there's the misperception of what concierges do. It goes so much more beyond just theater tickets and booking flights. And then the bottom line is they actually are, in the old school, a walking Rolodex. In the new school, a walking database. And they know everything. So with that as the introduction, Marie Lesterie, who's the chief concierge of the Prince de Galles, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, you heard my introduction. I'm assuming there are still Americans who are intimidated by the idea of a concierge.
Well, if it is the case, I don't really see it. The fact also that we are really at the what I would call the core center of the hotel. So we're in the lobby of the hotel. We're kind of their first, contact, whether it is us at the concierge, but also the rest of my team, the doorman, the bellboys. So it's all, we're here to welcome them. So I hope we're not too scary for them.
Well, see, I go beyond the idea that you're here to welcome this or them. You're also here to save the day, because you can either pull the rabbit out of the hat and do the magic when something goes wrong, or you get a request that's last minute, and you get a lot of those, I'm sure, right? So I guess my question is, in terms of those kinds of requests, how many guests have come up to say, I need to charter a 747 in an hour, can you get it for me? And you go out and get it for them. I mean, it's not just, I just want to go to see a play tonight. So what kind of interesting, challenging requests are you getting these days?
Well, there's a little bit of everything, you know, given that every single person is different, every single guest is obviously different as well. Even for me, the smallest of requests is an interesting one, even though they might not be the greatest challenge. But it's true that, like, charter a private jet, as long as it's humanly feasible, we'll do it, you know, humanly feasible and legal, of course.
Okay, so give me the most challenging legal request you've had.
Me personally, yeah. Or can I maybe use a request that my team had?
Sure, go ahead.
My assistant, Jean-Christophe, who's worked at the Prince de Galles for more than 25 years, had that request from a former guest at the hotel. He was attending a birthday party for a private function on Place Vendôme. And the theme of the party was black and white. And it was an original, you know, person, a one of a kind, I would say. And he said, well, find me an idea for that party. You know, I want to really stand out. And let's say he did. There were two little dwarf goats, a black one and a white one. And it was just like, he had them, Jean-Christophe had them, he found them in the countryside near Chartres or somewhere like that. And just keep in mind, the request was placed at 11 a.m. for 6 p.m. deadline. And so the guest arrived on Place Vendôme, coming out of his limo, and he had with two leash the two little dwarf goats, and he made his entrance. And he was like, it was the most amazing thing they had seen at the party. And I mean, the whole point is there is just like, that's exactly what the guest wanted, to stand out. And he did.
Okay, so I have one obvious question that begs to be asked. What happened to the goats?
Well, actually, that's the funny part of it.
Are they now in a suite at the hotel?
Yeah, of course, they live with us. the funny part is the owner of the goats said, well, no, I don't want to rent them, so you have to buy them. And Jean-Christophe said, well, your price is ours. So the guest bought the goats.
The guest bought the goats?
Absolutely. But then after the evening, he didn't want them anymore.
I hate when that happens.
But yeah. Then they were returned to their previous owners.
He just gave them back?
Yeah.
And they took them?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
But he didn't claim the money or anything.
He
returned the goats. So they're now living happily near Chartres.
So what you're telling me is that the Prince de Galles has an open goat policy?
Of course, we're pet friendly, absolutely.
Even if it's a goat.
If it fits in an elevator, then it works.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
The hotel closed in 2011 for massive renovations. It reopened in 2013. But before it closed, it was my secret place to go, the best lobster sandwich in Paris, without a doubt. And it reopened in 2013. And the first thing I said is, do you still have the lobster sandwich? And it was, no, we don't. They took it off the menu. But you replaced it with a different kind of lobster dish, didn't you?
Certainly. You have right now, you have all the signature dish of the chef, Stéphanie Lequelec. And you have a different huge preparation with maybe a nice caviar. or you have some egg from Île-de-France with some egg yolk, some nice espuma of green asparagus, and some morels just cooked with yellow wine.
Now, you mentioned that, by the way, that Cedric Mapoin, who is the chief sommelier and also the restaurant manager, so he knows the menu by heart, as you can hear this. The cool thing is you threw the caviar in, too.
Yes.
So, okay, I forgive you for the lobster sandwich now. I'll go for that. What would you say, you know, because hotel restaurants are always a very interesting challenge, because the traditional hotel restaurant was not exciting. The traditional hotel restaurant was, you know, meat and potatoes. And then over the last 15 to 20 years, hotels realized that you could not be an afterthought with your restaurant. You had to actually make a statement. And the chefs reflected that. The menu reflected that. Your guests were demanding it. So when you reopened the hotel in 2013, what did you want to make happen in La Seine, which is your prime dining restaurant?
I think, first of all, you have a different way. The first things, for me, the chef, to choose a great chef, a very young one. The name is Stéphanie Lekelec, who take the creation of the dining room, the kitchen, and she won the concours Top Chef. And it's telling for me, for the hotel, was a very good opportunity to make a good young chef. I think so. After she make a huge cuisine, very creative, with improvisation way, all the time. She chose some good food, and she want to make certainly a new cuisine with the French tradition recette.
Recipes. Now, when you say French tradition concept, when I hear French tradition concept, I'm thinking heavy sauces.
Yes. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Right now, you have a possibility to make some light sauce. To do, I have some a few idea about that, but she like to make some, you have like sabayon, is a traditional way. She put in siphon, or make something a little bit more light all the time. When I make some sauce, she's always to have the great taste of this sauce, but without butter, without olive oil, just to be a little bit fresh and direct.
Now, you also have a relatively special wine cellar.
Yes, it's one of... I love the wine, and I'm a chef sommelier too, and... In Prince de Galles, I have a huge selection of wine, with Burgundy, in Bordeaux, in as well in Rhone Valley, and from wine from around the world, like Italy, Spain, and Germany.
What would you say is your most popular wine here?
For me, the guests, I think the Burgundy wines. White and red, and champagne. You know, when you are in certainly one of the best places like Prince de Galles, with a nice glass, you can start your dinner or your aperitif always with a nice glass of champagne.
Now, for me, it's rosé.
Rosé champagne?
Absolutely.
Oh, but you have here a nice Laurent Perrier rosé.
I've been to the family residence. Oh. I've been to their champagne house. It's amazing. I mean, the whole family. And the daughter who runs it.
Yes, certainly.
Yes, of course. Amazing. And my friend Jean-Christian, who took me out there, it was an education for me. Yeah, so Laurent Perrier, I know it. It's great.
Oh, but it's a huge house for me, yes.
With so many different brands of champagne.
Ooh, in the cellar right now, you have 65 different champagne, different houses.
65?
Yes, you have some, because you have two different ways of champagne. You have some house, and you have as well some vigneron. It's a winemaker, very smaller place with maybe a production of 40,000 bottles each year. And if you have a house champagne, he produced 600,000 or 1 million bottles. And I love to work with house and winemaker.
Wow. All right, so 65.
Yes.
So you and I are going to go down there tonight and taste them all.
Yes.
No, we're not. We'll look at them all. Right?
Yes.
Exactly. What's the one item on your menu that everybody wants? And what's the one item on your menu that you tried and nobody wanted?
you have everybody wants always some wine from for me from Burgundy. Very difficult to find it. It's always the wine from Armand Rousseau. Certainly, everybody wants to buy one bottles because it's very difficult to get it.
See, so they're trying to buy the wine from you.
Yes,
too.
Yes.
Cédric Maupin, the chef sommelier and the manager of the restaurant La Seine, right here at the Prince de Galles. That music means we're out of time for the entire show. A lot of people to say thank you to. Dara Stone, our chief producer. Jeff Ryder doing the boards back in Connecticut. Alyssa Caverly doing the boards as the producer right here. Tim Hill, engineering right here. Marine Bachetta and Isabel Vigneron right here at the Prince de Galles. And the entire staff of the Prince de Galles Hotel here in Paris. Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.